Yeah, there's no democracy that is selectively applied depending on your religion or ethnic origin. Then you deserve democracy. But if you happen to be Arab or Palestinian or non-Jewish, then you don't, you're not worthy of that democracy. And I don't believe that this sort of charge, this vast generalization that the Arab world does not understand democracy. I've heard it from people like Netanyahu, now to Sharon and others, that the Arab world does not understand democracy, as though we are born lacking a gene, you know, a democratic gene. Or we are born with an extra gene called violent, even though we're the victims. We're on the receiving end of violence and on the receiving end of absence of democracy and on the receiving end of absence of human rights. Somehow it's our oppressor who has the monopoly on these things, and we ended up, you know, being described genetically as lacking these qualities. But the Arab world certainly, and the Arab regimes, particularly those who are linked to the US and to the West, are beginning to understand. A great thaw is coming. The threat of external conflict, national security, was always used as a very convenient pretext in order to maintain the status quo, to maintain the regimes in place, to avoid any type of accountability or respect for the rule of law and legislation of just laws, heaven knows. Many constitutions sound very good on paper, but there's no recourse, there's no application. So we need this transformation in the Arab world, and peace in itself, or the prospect of peace, is that which would dislodge these mechanisms, this control mechanism over the whole region. And the Arab people are moving, and we have the greatest example at the beginning of this intifada, where the Arab people, Arab public opinion, in a sense, mutinied against their own leaders, went out into the streets and expressed solidarity and sympathy with the Palestinian people, despite orders not to do so. There are still some leaders who order others, who order their people not to express this solidarity. But the Palestinian question still remains at the heart of any Arab self-definition of value. And it remains at the core of the Arab conscience. And I think all leaders have to understand that, including the those who have aligned themselves with the US and who feel that they depend on their legitimacy, for their legitimacy on external sources. And the Arab regimes kept saying that we have, that peace is a strategic commitment. I said, this is wonderful, but what is your strategy for peace? It's very easy, again, to adopt such facile statements, you know. We have a strategic commitment to peace. That's right. But peace has its own requirements and its own language, its own logic, its own necessary transformations. So you cannot say, peace is my strategic option. Peace has to have a strategy, and you have to struggle for it, and you have to work on it, and you have to regain your constituency for it, and you have to behave in a way that is consistent with it. Unfortunately, Israel continued to behave as an occupier with the mentality of occupation, domination, racism, violence, military force, and the Arab world continued in the absence, the Arab regimes, the absence of a human-based inclusive agenda for governance and development, and of course democracy. So there was no congruence there, which is a major reason for this instability and breakdown now, and why the whole region now feels destabilized and on the brink of the abyss. Again, the exclusive American monopoly, the exclusion of the UN, the source of legitimacy, the exclusion of other Arab players, the exclusion of Europe, our regional neighbors, have also weakened the peace process. But in addition, and perhaps even more dangerously, the adoption of a very exclusivist definition of security. It was a narrow definition based on Israel's priorities, that it has to be the personal security of every Israeli that has to be guaranteed before even there was any agreement, that security can be achieved by military means and pressure. And of course, that is a very short-term and narrow view of security. But more importantly, it dealt with security not, again, as a human-based inclusive security for the whole region, for both parties, but rather as security for the strongest party, the stronger party, without any guarantees or recognition of the security rights and needs of the weaker party. So here we were without any territorial, economic, personal, human, any type of security as Palestinians, and yet our leadership was held responsible for guaranteeing the security of the Israelis, which didn't work at all. And that again led to internal instability. Now, had everybody felt secure, you wouldn't need the peace process. You wouldn't need to try to search for peace. The only security is that which comes from signing a just peace agreement, and not you put a precondition that I will negotiate or I will sign agreements only once I'm sure that you've guaranteed the security of every individual. And this is another problem. Now, also within the Arab world, there is a dislodging of the traditional patterns of security without actually understanding that the new means of security have to be based, have to be human-based security, respect for human rights, democratic transformations, and a new sense of participatory democracy and inclusive governance. And there were, again, a series of false assumptions that I constantly hear here, and fallacies and misplaced priorities. One is, I've always talked about this, the assumption of a false symmetry between occupier and occupied. No, there is no symmetry, there is no parity of power between occupier and occupied, so you cannot tell both sides stop the violence or both sides, you know, disengage. We'd love nothing better than to stop the violence. But who's doing the violence, who's occupying other people's lands, who's shooting, who's shelling, who has all the military, it's not the Palestinians, and there's no symmetry. Of course, there's a total disregard, particularly in the Western press, of the fact of the occupation itself. Sometimes when I read the American press or hear the or watch television, it's as if, you know, there are two people who are in equal conditions, you know, neighbors, maybe two states fighting. This is not the case. The fact of the occupation is the most intrusive, pervasive form of violence and violation. And it should be addressed as such. There's also another false assumption that this is an ideological or religious conflict. It is not. It's not a religious conflict, and I describe it or to try to solve it by religious means. And I said this, that God cannot be made to take sides and conflicts like this. And God does not give any side absolute power control. And nobody is in possession of the absolute and total truth. This is a peace, this is a situation of conflict that has to be resolved on the basis of legality, human parity, and of course, through political negotiations. But the moment you start using God and making him take sides and claiming absolutes and absolute truths, then you guarantee a return to the zero-sum game and the no solution to any conflict. Also, another fallacy is that brute force and military assaults would lead to the Palestinians to capitulate or succumb. This isn't going to happen. Since 48 till now, ethnic cleansing has been tried. The total eradication and the 418 villages, the expulsion of people, a series of massacres. And now there is more ethnic cleansing with the shelling of the refugee camps and even with studies that are being published and looked at in civilized circles. I don't know if any of you have seen the latest studies that have come out from the Herzliya conference. in which they say the greatest danger is the demographic danger. So we have to find ways, first of all, of limiting birth control among the Palestinians within Israel. And if they don't do that, then we have to move them to a Palestinian entity within the West Bank and Gaza. And we have to impose on that entity birth control and limits, reproduction limits. And if they don't accept that, then we have to transfer them, move them to Jordan. Now, these things were generally talked about, whispered about. People felt ashamed, you know, using this kind of racist manipulation before. And anybody who was caught saying it was immediately frowned upon. Only this month, last month in Herzliya, there was the conference bringing together the greatest military minds and academic thinkers and ex-politicians and so on, who came up with this formula and who are publishing it and who presented it to Sharon in public in a ceremony. And I think that this resurgence, this revival of such sheer unadulterated racism is very, very dangerous. Not just for us, of course, for Israel as well. So gradually the logic of peace, the nature of peace, the discourse on it began to diminish. And of course, at leadership level, it was a very convenient slogan that everybody still used, but it's filtering down to people, maintaining a constituency for peace, a language, a mindset, an attitude disappeared. Because on the one hand, as I said, you had the mentality and mindset of the occupation being used in order to force the other side to accept a unilateral version or view of what peace is. So Israel felt that it was in a position to design and to dictate both the process and the outcome. And the impact was devastating at all levels. I don't have time to go into that. There were, again, serious distortions and manipulations of facts and misleading generalizations when it comes to what happened in the last round of talks. Many people, including these talking points, and I know Israeli government press office and the foreign ministry, and I know they hired lots of two major PR companies, and they've activated AIPAC and the Council of Presidents and everybody to blame the Palestinians for everything. First of all, there is this very nice statement. We were made a generous offer in Camp David, and we refused it, so how ungrateful are we? And what is or that Barak went further than anybody else in discussing permanent status issues. Let me enlighten you. It was the first time that we negotiated permanent status issues with anybody. We were late even in getting to these negotiations. So Barak was the first prime minister who negotiated permanent status issues. So of course he had to go further than anybody else because nobody else discussed them. Two, the generous offer was capable of destroying any chances of peace in the future. Because on the one hand, we were supposed to reward occupation by allowing them to annex bits and pieces of our land. Now, these are not just any bits and pieces. People tell us, well, they gave you about 90%. Of course, the 94% or whatever is entirely untrue because they didn't count Jerusalem and its areas or the Dead Sea. So they went up to 88 to 90% of the West Bank. Is it a question of percentages? Or is it a question of land theft and rewarding occupation and violating the basic precept of the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war? It's not that you can steal part of somebody's land, that's not theft. But to steal all of it is theft, is inadmissible. No, we said we will accept the 67 boundaries, that's 22% of historical Palestine, that's the minimum needed to create a viable, territorially contiguous state. And if you don't have that, and if you don't have a viable state, you will not have peace and stability throughout the region. Of course, we were told that the settlements must stay. There will be three major settlement clusters that will divide the West Bank into three different Bantustans, entirely disconnected and fragmented. Now, that means that we are giving retroactive legality to illegal acts, like the building of settlements, to the violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Of course, ending the possibility of having a viable Palestinian state and creating a situation of apartheid in the West Bank, I don't think they would have kept settlements in Gaza, even though now they're busy shelling everybody and destroying trees and fragmenting even Gaza, that Rabin said he wanted to see sink into the sea. Now that they're doing that, I don't think that they would leave any hope for any kind of peace alive. And of course, they wanted to annex Jerusalem but negotiate over bits and pieces of some holy sites and what kind of control and reinvent sovereignty. Again, we can discuss that later, but ultimately, also we have to eradicate the right of return of the Palestinian refugees. So we were given this very generous offer that totally violated the terms of reference of the peace process, violated international law. And then they turned around and said that we didn't behave like good little boys and girls, not just good little natives, because we have to be very grateful for whatever they give us, as though they're giving us their own land, or they are arbiters of what are our own rights. And then the other statement we keep hearing is stop the violence. These are convenient labels. I've heard more repetition of the term terrorist when it comes to Palestinian. We're back now to the language of pre-67 even. As though if you pull out a convenient label, you can rob people of their humanity, you can brand them, and that's it. Then you can avoid the consequences of your own actions because, of course, the Palestinians are terrorists. It's not that the Palestinians are under occupation and Israel is assassinating, shooting, shelling, destroying homes. No, it's the Palestinians who have to stop the violence. Take away the tanks, remove your gunships, remove the soldiers and checkpoints, end the strangulating siege. There is no violence. That's where the violence comes from. And one thing I always repeat is you cannot drive a people into desperation. Do not corner a whole people. Do not lead the Palestinians into desperation. This is extremely dangerous because people who are driven to desperation do desperate acts. What makes a young student, an engineering student, brilliant student, second year at Birzeit State University, every day, every night, seeing not only was the settlement built on his family land, the Tawil boy, Psagot was built on the Jabal al-Tawil, but every night, his house, his neighbors were being shelled. One boy was killed in his own home, in his own bedroom, next door to the Tawil boy. Every night there was shelling, people were killed, another man was shot, even in his own home. In his own home. And one day he disappeared. 2 days later, his parents had discovered that he had blown himself up next to an Israeli bus. He was the only one who died. But what would drive a student like that to desperation? And I think the whole study of martyrdom or the suicide bombers has to be looked into. I'm not justifying this. I think any loss of human life is tragic. But we have to remove the causes that would lead to such a... Yes, people like you. What would drive a young mind, a brilliant mind, to desperation? Think about it. And I think the conditions have to be dealt with, not the outcome. The sources, the causes have to be dealt with seriously. And we shouldn't try to justify or rationalize such horrible violations. So when you say Palestinians are terrorists, I say maybe you have one, two, three, maybe you have some organizations that target innocent civilians, and this is not acceptable. but I will not brand a whole nation as terrorists. And when you have an army that takes orders, that is regimented, that is the fourth strongest army in the world, the strongest army in the region, shooting children, using sniper fire to shoot children, to shell people's homes, to raise whole neighborhoods, to humiliate and beat people daily, to prevent you from going anywhere, to destroy your health services, your school services, every semblance of normal life. I call that state terrorism, and it has to stop. And this is not a war. Everybody's been saying this is a war. What war? We never declared war. We're not even in a position to fight a war. We are sitting ducks. We are being used for target practice. We didn't declare a war. This is a unilateral war because there's only one army. And therefore, to try to avoid responsibility by saying that the rules of engagement apply, therefore the rules of engagement must prevail, it means that you have made a whole population legitimate targets for a whole army. This is not acceptable. We are seeing a breakdown, and it's dangerous because it has a spillover effect, and violence could be unleashed on the whole region. And it's not just the economic interests of the US or the oil-rich countries, but more importantly, it's the human lives that will be lost that should be prevented. We find ourselves in a time warp again. We are back in history, before the peace process, before we desperately tried to legitimize the language of peace. What we find ourselves in is back to the language of negation, negation of even the legitimacy of your very existence and the most basic human rights, the most basic rights of existence. Sharon represents this time warp and his whole unholy alliance, even though many people try to present him as a new and improved Sharon. He's not a new and improved version. Those of you who remember his history, how many of you remember Qibya? How many of you are from Qibya? And you don't know about the Qibya massacre. Well, Sharon said it had to be done because people had to learn. So what they did in Qibya in 1952 was Sharon himself demolishing homes, blowing up homes with women and children in the houses screaming. And he told the people, the soldiers, not to listen. It had to be done. And he demolished. He was the head of the leader of the notorious 101 unit. And he did the same with several villages. He was known as the person who committed these massacres in cold blood and justified them on the point of political expediency. It had to be done. They had to teach the Palestinians a lesson. He's the one who started the Lebanon War. He's the one who invaded Lebanon in 1982. And he's the one who was responsible for the Sabra and Shatila massacres, the most horrific massacres, to the point where the Israeli public came out in massive numbers, 200,000, I think, protesting. And it was the Israeli commission that declared him unfit to be Minister of Defense. And the Israeli people as a whole were ashamed of Sharon then. Now he's prime minister. And he's busy negating our rights and our existence. Now, if this is something to be proud of or to laugh at or to smile at, I hope Sharon does not unleash his destructive forces internally within Israel. Sharon represents the extremist right-wing political ideology with the most extreme fundamentalist religious ideologies, with them return to a militaristic mindset, because that's the rule of the generals is back. And to add insult to injury, they recruited people like Peres to be their apologists. This is a very dangerous combination, and I think we all have to be on the lookout, because while you're destroying others, dehumanizing others, you start with your own dehumanization and self-destruction. This unholy alliance might take us back to the fundamentalist issues of the right to exist. And that's serious. Because when we get back to the zero-sum game, then there has to be a winner, a loser, a survivor, and a victim. And this is something we try to change by saying there is room for both peoples. Now I think that we are in danger of seeing a negation of the logic of peace. That's why we have to intervene and to prevent this government from doing irreparable damage to the chances, to the prospects of peace in the future. What is Sharon's agenda? He doesn't want to reach a permanent status agreement. He wants a series of partial temporary agreements while he stays in control, continuing with settlement activities, continuing with land annexation, maintaining the security control over the Jordan Valley, and of course annexing Jerusalem altogether and negating the Palestinian refugees' right of return, and annexing 58% of the West Bank. And if we don't like it, he's going to shell us and bomb us and then tell us stop the violence. And if we don't like it, he's going to arrest more people, destroy more homes, and call us terrorists. This is not a formula for peace. It's a very serious provocation for war. And as I said earlier, it's been tried before. It doesn't work. The Palestinians will never be battered and beaten into submission. One thing we have is our will. And the occupation can never be normalized. But I will end with two things. One, if Zionists take their ideology to an extreme like Sharon, if they seem to think that they can repeat 1948 with ethnic cleansing and with annexation of land and negation of a whole nation, if he thinks that he can continue the occupation, annex land without the people, not only is this the 21st century and he cannot do it in the dark, what he'll be doing is blurring the divide. At one point in history, we said, there is a chance for a two-state solution on Palestinian land, that Palestine and Israel can coexist side by side as two equal states, as neighbors. But if people like this government and others continue blurring the divide, making the two-state solution impossible, then not only will they remove the possibility, destroy the possibility of peace, they will condemn both Palestinians and Israelis to a generation or two of conflict, but ultimately Zionism will self-negate because the demographics will take over, the argument, the racist argument they're afraid of. If they do not want to separate, if I may use another cliche, if they do not let my people go, if they do not give up and end the occupation and accept a Palestinian state on the 67 boundaries, and they continue to bring in settlers and annex land, you will end up with a binational state. The only solution will be the one-state solution. Because we're not ready to disappear. We're not going to die collectively. We're not going to suffer from collective amnesia and forget our history and identity. And we're not going to commit collective suicide or transfer, as Sharon wants. We're staying. And that means that Israel, as envisaged by Zionism, as a purely Jewish or predominantly Jewish state, will no longer be that. Because it'll be a binational state. It'll be like South Africa. And now there are all these arguments coming out in favor of separation because they're worried about the demographic argument. Because they discovered we're not going away. So in a sense, give us back what is ours, the minimal of what is ours, and there will be a two-state solution. If not de facto, by default, you will have a one-state solution. The next generation or two, there'll only be a cry for democracy. One person, one vote. That's it. The other thing is this claim at neutrality. I don't believe in neutrality, if I may say so. I believe in even-handedness. I believe in justice. But there is such a thing as cowardly neutrality. In the face of oppression, of assassinations, of murder, of deliberate violations and dehumanization, nobody can be neutral. I think it is time for people of courage, of principle, of conviction to intervene. Neutrality is an excuse, not just for cowardice, but an excuse for paralysis. And we all have to take sides when you see a situation of injustice. And when we see a chance for peace, that's when you have to abandon your neutrality, because there's no parity between conflict and death and destruction on the one hand, and peace and development and democracy on the other. So I hope we all would take sides, we would not be neutral, and we would take sides in favor of justice and in favor of peace and the human imperative. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Ashrawi will take a good number of questions until she signals that she's done her best for the evening.
Thank you, Dr. Ashrawi, for the inspiring remarks and lecture. I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about the human side of Palestinians, about the poets, the philosophers, teachers, mothers. Mm. But maybe you could talk about that later. But could you explain the hypocrisy, both in the media and coming out of the U.S. government, when they always insist on Chairman Arafat and the Palestinian Authority that they have to crack down on Hamas, Jihad, all people who are against Israel, to eliminate all insights of violence. And at the same time, they criticize the human rights record of Arafat. Yeah. And for the record, being a Palestinian woman coming out of Jerusalem, could you tell us which group or nation did help most the Palestinian cause? Thank you.
Okay, I'll try to answer very quickly. I wish I could have the time to talk about the human side and what it means to be a Palestinian, and not just in terms of pain and suffering, but in terms of accomplishments and pride of identity. But it would require a whole course, not just another lecture, to talk about Palestinian culture and human reality and endeavors. As far as the hypocrisy, yes, there is a hypocrisy when it comes to human rights, cracking down on the opposition, as I said, preventing incitement and so on, and at the same time asking the Palestinian Authority to uphold the rule of law and to recognize human rights. I gave the most, I think the most notorious example we have is Al Gore's example. When we were busy writing statements, and I personally went to Arafat, repeatedly asked him to abolish the state security courts because these are military courts that have no relationship to justice. And on his one visit to I think it was in Jericho, Al Gore stood up and praised the state security courts because he said these demonstrated that Arafat was serious about the peace process. So this is the not just the hypocrisy, but the internal distortion that we saw. As far as which group or country or whatever, in various degrees, there have been many people who have helped. I'm not going to give you a superlative and say these have been the most helpful or the most. There have been many. I think it's the people. Whether it's the Arab people, the Islamic world, or whether it is people of conscience everywhere. There have been also grassroots movements here in the States and peace movements here that have been extremely helpful. There have been certain movements in churches, the black students movement, the African Americans, even indigenous Americans. In the States, you're talking about this, or are you throughout the world? In terms of funding and so on, I don't consider the finances as being the sole determinant of support. There have been many who've helped. Let's say Europe, for example, has contributed more than any other country or donor to the redevelopment or the reconstruction and development plan. But again, we lost in these last 7 months more than all the donor funding that was pledged or was given since the signing of the agreement. So it's not the funding. I'm afraid I'm not going to single out a single group or individual or country for support. Unfortunately, most people give you lip service or romantic support. Very few people sort of have the courage to transform their words into deeds or action. This way.
Ma'am, I think that in trying to solve any sort of conflict, it'd be really important for both sides to understand what the other side wants. And throughout the lecture, I think we got an understanding of, in part maybe, what your people want, but I wondered what do you feel that your diplomatic counterparts or have the conflict with? What do you feel that their long-term interests are and what their goals are out of this peace process?
Fine. I didn't know you clapped for questions, but I understand this group wants to listen to this. Yes. Listen, if we had as many speakers and as many organizations and as much funding as the pro-Israeli lobby has in the States, then I think we would be able to talk about both sides. I'm here as a Palestinian, not as an Israeli. But how do I see the Israelis? What do they want? Yes, I'm one of those who've started the dialogue with the Israelis. And I'm very proud of it in the early 70s when it was not done, when nobody would talk to Israelis and when Israelis were punished for talking to Palestinians. We started an activist movement, we had a coalition, then we developed. The women's movement came later, actually the late 70s, early 80s. Before that, it was mainly the activist resistance against the occupation. Well, you're interrupting me. So in many ways, I have an understanding of what the Israelis want from those who have really put their money where their mouth is and who took risks and who didn't sit here in luxury and just throw out words or write erroneous speeches like this, like these yellow blue pages. And it is these Israelis that I respect. I tell them, give me an Israeli to talk to any time. It's much more honest and immediate than it is with the pro-Israeli lobbyists who sit here and think that they have a monopoly on what's good for Israel. Israel wants legitimacy. This is very important because Israel has always been looked at as, I'm sorry if I'm not looking at you. You're the one who asked the question. Yes. Israel wants legitimacy. It wants to be accepted in the region. It wants to be normalized. It doesn't want to feel that it is an abnormal, artificial construct imposed in the midst of an Arab area. And of course, all along there was a rejection of Israel because it was created on Palestinian land and at the expense of Palestinians. So it was up to us as Palestinians, as the victims, to tell Israel, you have the chance to get this legitimacy if you recognize not just your historical guilt, but the right of the Palestinians. So in a sense, the key to Israel's legitimacy is the Palestinians. And it is ironic because they cannot destroy us and be legitimate. They have to understand that we have to accept the sharing of the land. Two, the Israelis want security. Now there is an illogic here. We all want security. It's everybody's right to be safe. Security comes with peace. Now you cannot have occupation with impunity, and you cannot have security when you're occupying other people's lands. So they have to understand that. Two, they have to understand that you cannot have, as we said, security while you are violating other people's rights. And you cannot have security before peace. You have to have peace that produces security. You have to have new sets of relationships to introduce a new dynamic. Now, there are many Israelis who understand that. Right now, I believe there is a regression to the past. There was a knee-jerk reaction when they came close to permanent status issues and understood what is needed. They decided, well, maybe we should go back to the language and the mechanisms of the past, of force, of violence, of oppression, of brutality, and we will keep shelling and pounding and killing those Palestinians till they submit. That's not going to happen. So security has to come from understanding that there is a mutual dependence. And this we have to deal with, understanding also that there is a larger context, regional and Arab context. Israel cannot normalize with anybody if it continues to be in this abnormal relationship with the Palestinians. Israelis, I've been told by many of them that the reason we don't trust Palestinians is because if somebody did to us what we did to you, we will never forgive and forget. And I say we are willing to start a new relationship, but you cannot constantly go back to the past. And both legitimacy, acceptance, security, normalization, these all come with the forging of a just peace. And I talked to enough Israelis to understand what they want and what they think without having to be their spokesperson. Heaven knows it's difficult enough to be a Palestinian spokesperson, and there are very few of us. But we understand them. As I wrote in the Madrid speech, I said to the Israelis, you have nothing to hide from us. We know you. We have seen you at your worst, and we have seen you at your best. And we know what you're capable of. Because as an occupier, they cannot hide from us. So we understand them. The thing is, how do we create a paradigm shift? How do we create a new phase, a new set of concepts, of relationships that are not subject to the distortions of occupation and military force, and that understand that there is equality of rights, even though there is disparity of power? Okay? All right.
Hi. Dr. Ashrari, my question is twofold. First, wouldn't it be more effective for the Palestinians to use nonviolent means and practice civil disobedience, since it's clear that under current lethal methods, such as firing live ammunition, throwing rocks and firebombs, and most recently firing of mortars and anti-tank missiles at settlements, that's not effective? And secondly, if the Palestinians are going to, obviously not all of them.
Are going where?
If the Palestinians are going to be firing from certain positions, why don't you think Yasser Arafat, as the leader, recognized leader of the Palestinian people, is encouraging these people not to be firing from civilian positions in their homes, which then require Israel, at least Israel says, with no choice, to then demolish those homes and vineyards and whatnot? So
you made a statement through a question, yes. Okay. Nonviolent means I do... We're not debating, this is a discussion. I agree with you. I think nonviolence is very important. We started the first intifada also by nonviolent means, and we were the ones, I tell you, I joined every protest, every march, and I was shot at, and I was beaten up, and I was tear gassed, and they used immediately live ammunition against us. So you can use nonviolent means, and you would continue, but what happened with this intifada is that from day one, it started out nonviolent, there were 7 people killed, unarmed people shot by the Israeli army. The next day there were 8 people shot and killed. Don't say no, I know, and I'll give you their names. So even though you advocate nonviolent means, and you start with nonviolent means, and I'm a person who joins every nonviolent protest. I joined the Beer Zayt march, and we were shot at, and we were tear gassed. I joined the intellectuals march, the artists march, and of course we were beaten up. I joined the women's march, and we were shot at. So it doesn't matter. I will continue, and I will try to legitimize the language of nonviolence. I don't call it civil disobedience because we are not Israeli citizens. This is an occupation. I will not ever accept. I will not accept Israeli rule, no matter what, because this is an illegal rule anyway, and I have never taken orders from Israelis, and I will not accept them. Even when I was arrested and interrogated and beaten up, I never accepted an Israeli order. There's a freedom of spirit here. Now, when it comes to, you said firing from civilian positions, yes. There were individuals, there were many people who were mad at me and people like me, who were talking about nonviolence, because they said, we are humiliated, we are helpless daily, we are seeing our children being killed, we are seeing people killed, we are seeing women shot at, we are seeing houses demolished, and we have to do something about it. You cannot control the behavior of every individual. There are people who did go and who did shoot, and they shot, and what kind of weapons do they have? Do they have tanks? Do they have
anti-tank weapons?
Wait a minute. They didn't have anything except pistols, and they didn't even reach any settlement. But they were sniped at, they were shot, they were killed. And they decided this is one way of self-defense. Excuse me. They were trying to defend themselves. Okay? Now, unfortunately, for a Palestinian to use a stone or a pistol is considered terrorism, even against an army. But for an army to use tanks and shelling and gunships, this is not terrorism. So we were the ones who had to maintain the higher moral ground. And I agree. I agree. We have to maintain the higher moral ground. But I would ask Israel and its apologists to question themselves. When they claim they have the best snipers in the world, why do they shoot children in their own bedrooms, in their own schools, in their backyards?
10-month-old children sitting in cribs.
I also would tell you, who gives any country, any army, the right to shell your home, no matter what, to demolish your home, to raise your crops, to uproot your trees, to imprison you? Who gives anybody that right? The age of slavery is over. That's it. Yes, sir.
Dr. Ashrawi, I do realize that this is very emotional and very sensitive, and I do respect you for maintaining your composure, walking us through this memory lane. Sometimes we hear Israelis saying, this is our land. We hear Palestinians saying, this is our land. Mm-hmm. We do agree with both of you because each person deserves to have a place they can call home. We cannot go into biblical times. Neither can we go into pre-1948 or post-1948. We can only concern ourselves with 1967. If Israelis decide to accept 1967 accord, this means that they have to cede Jerusalem. They have a vested interest in Jerusalem just like Palestinians do. right now, let's face it, the world is mourning. Is there a practical way where the question of Jerusalem can be solved to avoid this bloodshed?
Yeah.
Because this head-on collision with a dominant force, in my opinion, does not make any scientific or does not have any scientific basis.
Okay.
These people have the capability to
doesn't
wipe out...
Doesn't have a human basis, not a scientific basis, yes.
Israel has the capability to wipe out the whole Palestinian people in a matter of days. Let us be practical to ourselves. Yeah. Would you soften your stance a little bit on Jerusalem?
Would I? Yeah,
so that this shelling would stop and the world will be in peace. Let's give peace a chance so that the world will stop this agony. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. It's not only the question of Jerusalem, even though Jerusalem is a city greater than itself, but the shelling and the conflict and the violence and the tragic loss of life come from a variety of reasons which I had hoped I was able to explain at least partially today. Jerusalem is one of the issues. Now, of course, there are claims to the land. I don't believe that you can reorganize the world on the basis of holy texts or books. And I don't believe, I believe that Palestine, pre-48 Palestine was a Palestinian homeland and a state. And I believe that Israel was created as a construct on Palestine. And that holy text was used, the Bible was used in a way as to legitimize the creation of a state of Israel, a contemporary state. But I've always said religious texts do not make for good geopolitical contemporary blueprints. However, now that Israel does exist, we have to deal with that and accept that and move on, as you said, yes, move on to 67. But it doesn't mean that I will adopt the historical narrative of Israel. I have my own historical narrative. And there are many brave Israeli historians, the post-Zionists, the new historians, who are gradually exposing the truth and the accurate historical narrative. Jerusalem, as it stands, is still subject to UN Resolution 181, which designated as a corpus separatum. Israel occupied West Jerusalem in 1948. We still own over 78% of West Jerusalem as private property, even though it has become Israeli. That has to be solved as well. Now, in East Jerusalem, there are settlements within and around East Jerusalem. The Palestinians could not build on their own lands in East Jerusalem. It took you from 10 to 20 years to get a permit, if you get it, costing anywhere from $10,000 to $80,000, $100,000 to get a permit, and you couldn't build. Israel confiscated and turned into Greenland most of the Palestinian territories of Jerusalem and left us with only 12% of what we own to build on. So that there is a distortion in Jerusalem. There is an imbalance, demographic and territorial imbalance in Jerusalem. We cannot, that's why we cannot say we will start now from here. Having Israel having confiscated land, brought in settlers, even Sharon has a house that they confiscated in the old city. And with people like Moscovich in the States, who's willing to fight up to the last Israeli and the last Palestinians, provided he can build settlements with his bingo money from here. So we need to address the issue of Jerusalem as a city that can and should be open, both East and West Jerusalem. And we propose this. You can't say that now that they took West Jerusalem, it is theirs, let's see how they can share East Jerusalem. No. We said, let's put all of Jerusalem on the table, East and West, and let's see how we can have one open city. And I'm sorry for all of those of you who are standing up, but I really have to stop at 9. So the issue of Jerusalem can be solved if you overcome the mentality of acquisition and greed. Religious and spiritual affiliation with any city or any place in the world has never been and must never be a reason for the exercise of sovereignty. Otherwise, you know, anybody from Afghanistan, the Taliban should claim Mecca and Medina because they have religious affiliation there. All Catholics.
That was Professor Hanan Ashrawi speaking at Cornell University last month. Public opinion in Israel regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is by no means unanimous, as this post from the Canadian-based A-Infos News Service shows. This from Thursday, April 12th. Three young Israelis were arrested for driving a car through Tel Aviv as they broadcast through a loudspeaker. Quote, "A curfew has been imposed on Tel Aviv. Residents must enter their homes. People seen on the streets after 7:30 p.m. risk responses according to the usual procedures," close quote. A second car with the same message made a successful getaway. Police arrested the two young women and one young man and charged them with, quote, "terrorizing the public," close quote. The writer of this post, Gila Svirsky, commented that he wished that politicians and generals could be similarly charged for making the same statements in Hebron and other Palestinian cities. In that same vein, another group of young people planned to, quote, "lay siege to an upscale Israeli community where many of the generals reside." An announcement of that call to action read, "Kokav Yair is a place inhabited by several army generals who endanger both our security and the security of the whole region. Therefore, for security reasons, tomorrow, Thursday, April 11th, we will put a siege on this place to prevent these dangerous people from leaving it to go about their harmful business. Needed: people, vehicles, and tools. Those interested in participating, please contact us as soon as possible." A few weeks earlier, another group had staged a march with signs calling for restoration of the British Mandate. Though this perhaps confused some onlookers, the message was clear. British colonial rule of Palestine was in many ways more benign than the Israeli occupation. And the commenter says in closing, "The most optimistic news lately is the growing reluctance of Israeli men to show up for Army Reserve duty. While not generally motivated by ideological reasons, this very absence of ideology is what is so encouraging." And that from Gila Svirsky of Jerusalem, posted on the A-Infos News Service based in Toronto.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will all